I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 7th of August. On Monday of this week, people in Toledo, Ohio, were told by the mayor that it was okay to use the city's water again, and he took a big gulp of water at a press conference he held. For several days, residents were told not to drink the water, not to brush their teeth, don't give the water to pets, and be careful bathing in the water. Many residents, understandably, were a little careful about taking their first sip of water on Monday. The problem was Lake Erie, the source of the water, the drinking water, which is increasingly being choked each summer by algae. And much of the algae is poisonous. It comes from phosphorus washed from fertilized farms, cattle feedlots, and leaky septic systems. And there is some history of water advisories before this summer. Last year in Ohio, Carroll Township suspended water use last September when they had the second largest algae bloom ever measured. We're going to be looking at not only what's going on in Toledo, but the problem with water. And there are so many different factors here. Nonpoint pollution is a factor. Climate change is a factor. Mining is a factor. What it is that's causing these kinds of problems, what it is the federal government could do about this, state government could do about this, and if indeed, if we don't see more regulations, if we're going to see problems in other Great Lakes and in other water basins that are used for drinking water in communities all over the country. An important topic and a frightening topic as well. We'll have two guests with us during the course of the hour. We start with Dave Dempsey, who's been a policy advisor for the U.S. section of the International Joint Commission since 2011, concentrating on Great Lakes water quality matters. He served as a member of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and also as environmental advisor to Michigan Governor James Blanchard for a number of years, has worked for a number of nonprofit environmental organizations, and is author of On the Brink, The Great Lakes in the 21st Century. A little bit later this hour, Professor Val Klump will join us, professor and associate dean of research in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. He has worked with the Great Lakes Water Institute for the past decade, and we will be speaking with him about Lake Michigan and more about the topics we'll cover with Dave Dempsey. For the whole hour, please feel free to join our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Dave Dempsey, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Kathleen.
So tell me, what were the reasons that people in Toledo were not drinking the water? What was the poisonous source of algae? How did it become poisonous?
Well, that's a very long story, but I'll try to summarize it quickly. Essentially, what happened, has been happening, is that farm runoff and sewage discharges from sources along Lake Erie have been feeding algae blooms, and the combination of phosphorus and warm temperatures and shallow water in western Lake Erie have allowed these blooms to flourish and to allow the expansion of blooms that include a toxic form of algae called blue-green algae or microcystin. And that toxin has been linked to animal deaths and sickness in human beings, so to drink it is not a wise idea.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that the one that provides water to Toledo, that there was a pipe that was somewhere offshore and that there was a bloom of this kind of algae right over the intake?
That's true. Some people have asked, why did this happen to Toledo's drinking water at a time when the bloom actually is smaller in extent than it was in 2011? 2011 was the record algae bloom year. This year, it's smaller, but it happened to have taken place, part of it happened to take place right where Toledo gets its drinking water. So that's been the reason for the crisis of the last weekend.
So let's break down the problem here. Let's start with farm runoff. Why is that a problem?
Well, farm runoff results generally from an excess of phosphorus fertilizer or animal waste. And total phosphorus has pretty much stayed stable in terms of pollution over the last 15 years, but a form of phosphorus called soluble reactive phosphorus has increased. That's a form that as the scientists say, is more bioavailable, can feed the algae, blooms faster. And so people are looking at whether particular farm practices have allowed this form of phosphorus to increase.
And what would those practices be?
Well, they could be, actually, ironically, some of the things that we've been urging farmers to do, including no-till, no tillage, conservation tillage, which allows, stabilizes the soil and allows, reduces soil sediment running off into the waters, but actually can leave more phosphorus in the upper layers of the soil and allow it to feed into the rivers and streams. So that's one source. There's also been a dramatic increase in the number of large animal farms operations in the Maumee River watershed, which feeds western Lake Erie. So those are two of the causes.
Mm-hmm. What about the warmth of Lake Erie, this part of Lake Erie, and I guess the lake as a whole? Has it been warming significantly?
Well, it is the warmest Great Lake, and the western basin is among the shallowest areas of the Great Lakes. And so it warms up faster, even in a year like this where we've had a cold winter and spring. And so it's particularly vulnerable to these kinds of pollutants. We have seen, not year by year, but overall over the last 20 years, a gradual increase in the temperatures of not just Lake Erie, but most of the Great Lakes.
So that allows the algae to grow more?
Yeah, it provides perfect breeding grounds for algae.
Mm-hmm. And what about sewer overflows?
Well, sewer overflows can be a significant source. Obviously, an overflow means the wastewater is not treated, but it actually bypasses the sewage treatment facility. So the phosphorus and other pollutants that are in the water go basically untreated into the rivers and streams. What scientists don't know is to what extent a major facility like the Detroit Wastewater Treatment Plant contributes to western Lake Erie's problem. That still needs to be further researched, but even so, they do believe that the majority of the problem comes from agriculture.
Mm-hmm. 5 years ago, according to a piece in the New York Times a couple days ago, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, along with state water agencies, issued a report on pollution on the nation's waterways by phosphorus and other nutrients titled An Urgent Call to Action. The senior lawyer for the water program at the Natural Resources Defense Council says, unfortunately, very little action has come from that. Why is that? And would you agree that very little action has come from that?
Yeah, I generally agree. I think the reason is that the same reason that so many problems are solved only after a crisis, and that is we don't take them seriously until we see something dramatic go wrong. And even though what happened in Toledo last weekend is very unfortunate, hopefully it will stimulate action and serve as a warning bell for the need to do something for the phosphorus problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, does it do just that? If I were living in Toledo, I'd be pretty afraid to drink the water, quite frankly, even now, even though the mayor took a sip of it. That was a dramatic warning. Don't even brush your teeth with this water.
It was, and it reminds me of the phenomenon back in the 60s when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire. That kind of dramatic illustration of a pollution problem really galvanized actions in the 70s, including the Clean Water Act. Hopefully, this crisis will galvanize action of a similar strength and nature. I wouldn't worry too much about drinking Toledo's water at this point, but the utility is going to need to keep very vigilant day by day to make sure that the water is not, again, contaminated seriously, because the algae bloom can drift back and forth and grow depending on weather and wind conditions.
Mm-hmm. And what have they done to it, Dave, that allowed them to lift the ban after a few days? What did they do to the water?
Well, part of it was just that the bloom drifted away from the intake.
So I see.
The amount of microcystin in the water was not at a hazardous level. That's primarily what happened. Toledo and other cities along the western Lake Erie shore do treat for this pollutant, and Toledo alone has spent $1 million in the last year just to upgrade its treatment for that pollutant. So it's costing municipalities money just to be monitoring it and taking action.
Mm-hmm. Have we seen this kind of bloom always, or is it new?
We've seen it before, especially in Lake Erie over the last 10, 15 years, but it's been growing. We've seen nuisance algae, which is a different kind of algae, for many years in various areas of the Great Lakes. Green Bay, for example, has had nuisance algae, which is unsightly and makes swimming and fishing unpleasant, to put it mildly. But that kind of algae does not pose the same health risk. So we're really starting to see a proliferation of the toxic algae beyond what we've seen over the past decades.
So what do we need at this point? Some kind of federal regulation, or will the state of Ohio regulate farming in the area and nonpoint pollution, or what's to happen to make things better?
Well, under our system of water laws, states take the lead under the Clean Water Act. And I would say that Wisconsin has actually done a pretty good job of starting to deal with the phosphorus issue in Green Bay. They've put together a plan for allocating the reductions amongst the sewage treatment plants and the farms. Ohio and Michigan, which both feed Western Lake Erie, have not done that. They aren't even at that stage. So that's the first thing that should happen, is for the states to own up to the problem and begin developing a cleanup plan. The issue of whether farming needs to be regulated or we should continue to rely on voluntary incentives is a big one. Obviously, farmers, agricultural lobbies resist the idea of regulation, but we've tried the voluntary incentive-based approach for many years, and it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
So probably need a combination of carrots and sticks.
Has Ohio dealt with the issue of wetlands? I understand that they filter phosphorus from the runoff water.
Well, not really. I mean, what you say is true. They are an important filtration, natural filtration system, but the Maumee River Basin has lost, I believe the figure is more than 90% of its wetlands over the years, and there's not been much effort to restore large areas, and that does need to be part of the prescription. The IJC put that recommendation in our report, which came out in February, that wetlands be restored as one of the remedial measures.
And what about alternatives to some of the fertilizers that are being used on farms now, or some other way to rid the farms of the animal waste? Is there a way to do that?
Well, there are definitely ways to reduce the runoff of fertilizer. I don't think we're going to see a radical change in the kind of fertilizer, but we've seen farmers apply fertilizer in the fall and apply sometimes animal waste in the winter on frozen or snow-covered ground, and that's contributing to the problem. There are market reasons why it's cheaper for farmers to buy fertilizer in the fall, and that's led to the application then. So trying to diminish or reduce that, or eliminate that, I should say, is actually very important. The farm community has come up with what they call the 4R program, which has to do with a voluntary approach to apply the right amount of fertilizer at the right time in the right place. And that can work, but it requires a lot of sophisticated technology to monitor and make sure it's working.
Mm-hmm. Well, forgive me, but if you're dealing with a possible threat to human health because people can't drink the water and they can't have their pets even drink the water, it would seem to me as though this would be such a startling development that indeed you would step in and say, we got to regulate this somehow. We can't have a city where people can't drink the water, or we can't have a city.
Well, you'd think so, but attitudes toward government solutions to environmental problems have definitely changed since the early 70s when the earlier algae problem was dealt with. I think there's a lot more sophistication in the lobbies that fight against regulation, and I think it's going to be an uphill battle to get regulation established. I think the best we can hope for is some limited regulation to ban some of these practices I just mentioned, such as applying animal waste to frozen ground, and then perhaps much more intensive work with individual farmers that are the largest contributors of phosphorus, whether it's incentive-based or with strict oversight. But regulation alone is not going to solve the problem.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Dave Dempsey is with us the first half of this hour. He's policy advisor for the U.S. section of the International Joint Commission, concentrating on Great Lakes water quality matters. He is also worked as a member of the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. This affects fishing as well, and an environmental advisor to Michigan Governor James Blanchard from 83 until 89. We're talking this hour about the people in Ohio who now can drink the water, but for several days last weekend could not drink the water because it was filled with algae that was poisonous. So how big a problem is this for residents there? And are there other waterways that are in trouble? Do we need to change the way we do farming, the way we deal with pollution, the way we deal with mining, et cetera, in order to ensure that our water quality is pure? And we'll talk more this second half hour about the influence of climate change on our lakes as well. Here's our phone number. Call early to get your calls in for Dave, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hour two of our program today, another in her series, Paying Till It Hurts, Elizabeth Rosenthal from the New York Times on the price of prevention, the vaccine costs are soaring. How so and why? To your phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Dave Dempsey, and we'll start with Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks so much for the show, Kathleen. I'm really grateful that you're discussing this topic. I grew up on the west side of Cleveland. I was a child in the 50s and a teenager in the 60s. Those were the bad old days when Lake Erie was dead. You'd go to a beach in our neighborhood, and there were always dead fish on the shore, and you never in the water, not even wading. In August, the tap water would smell like water you'd boiled corn in. I left there in 1974, and your guest sort of answered this question. Perhaps he could elaborate, though. I thought the lake had made a comeback and was alive again. People were fishing and swimming. What happened?
Good question. You know, Lake Erie's recovery was a worldwide, world-known success story for many years in the 80s and 90s. The lake did rebound. I can remember myself, because I was a Michigan resident at the time, the difference in the water between the mid-60s and the mid-70s went from pea soup to pretty clear appealing water. What's happened in the last 20 years is a combination of several things. One we have not talked about yet is the role of invasive species, which weren't present in the 60s. Mussels in particular, the invasive mussels, do appear to be contributing by making some of the phosphorus that they strain and excrete more available for algae. The other big difference is that it was fairly easy to control, Not cheap, but fairly easy to control algae, phosphorus back in the 60s and 70s. And that was done through a combination of better wastewater treatment and the reduction of phosphorus in laundry detergent. So you could sort of control it through centralized mechanisms. Now we've got individual farms and many homes contributing phosphorus, and it's much harder to get at.
Mm-hmm. What about all that stuff that people use on their lawns to keep a single dandelion from blooming? Is that contributing in any significant way?
It's contributing less and less. Most of the states in the Great Lakes Basin have banned phosphorus-containing fertilizers for most lawn uses, so that's a smaller factor. Ohio, though, has not yet done so, so maybe a larger contributor in mm-hmm. the Lake Erie situation.
Thank you, Marty, for your call. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Hi. 2 years ago, ABC National News did a story on blue-green algae, and they came to peat and well flowage on the Wisconsin River in central Wisconsin. Our state representative, Scott Krug from Wisconsin Rapids, he testified a couple years ago that we do not know what's causing the blooms in peat and well. The DNR told me we know exactly what is causing the blooms. It's fire and runoff, and they know exactly where it's coming from. Right now, Wysocki Farms wants to put in the 7,000-acre Golden Sand Dairy in the town of Saratoga near the peat and well flowage, and this would further endanger the peat and well flowage. The townspeople of the town of Saratoga have been fighting for the last year or two to prevent that huge factory farm from going in.
Dave.
Well, I can't speak to that specific situation, but there does appear to be a significant contribution of these large farms to the phosphorus problem in Lake Erie. And all I could say with respect to what you are talking about is that these facilities should have some kind of pollution target written into their permits. Most of them don't have specific phosphorus limits written into the permits, and there should be, because that's the only way to keep a legal control on these discharges.
Mm-hmm. And tell me once again why there's nothing written into the law when it comes to phosphorus limits. Is that due to the power of the fertilizer lobby? Can it be?
Well, there are limits written into the so-called point sources like sewage plants, but for farm runoff, there are not. And I think it is partly a result of successful lobbying for many years. No one really wants to regulate individual farmers. It's sort of contrary to our national traditions. But we've gotten to the point where agriculture is so intensive that there needs to be some kind of controls on the runoff.
Well, the farmers have to drink the water as well.
They do, but a lot of the water that's fouled is downstream. And, of course, none of us farmers or others are really thinking about what's downstream.
One more call for you. I know you have to go. We have another guest coming up. Ned in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I think we need to make it a priority to reduce phosphorus loading into the Great Lakes watershed. I know it costs a fair amount, actually, for better sewage treatment plants and point sources, and we've been talking a lot about non-point sources in agriculture today. And both of them are really important. And so it's just a matter of priorities and making sure that we send our tax dollars to where they're needed. And when we get a toxic algae bloom, fortunately, Lake Michigan isn't as shallow as Lake Erie. And if it were, we might very well have the same problem here. But my understanding is in the top layer, the epilimnion of Lake Erie, this toxic species built up in density, and then there was a wind that drove the toxic algae to high density at the west end of the lake, which is where Toledo is located. So we've got to simply, especially around Lake Erie and maybe to a lesser extent Lake Ontario, which is deeper than Lake Erie but not as deep as the other three Great Lakes, we need to reduce the phosphorus loading significantly, because phosphorus is the limiting nutrient for these algae that become very high densities and can cause human health effects.
Thanks for your call, Ned. Dave?
I would agree with that. I would just add that Saginaw Bay in Michigan and Green Bay in your listening area are both fairly shallow, and so they might have a problem of this kind in the future if the waters continue to warm. But so far, we haven't seen that. I also wanted to get in and mention that, as I said, the International Joint Commission that I work for put out a report in February laying out solutions, proposed solutions for the problem of Western Lake Erie, and I would encourage listeners to look at that. It's on our website, ijc.org.
ijc.org. And it's in the hands of important people who will make decisions, I assume, right?
Yeah, we refer those reports to the U.S. and Canadian governments, and hopefully they'll be responding shortly.
Are you discouraged by all of this?
No, you know, I'm really not. I think that we've shown in the last 50 years that when the Great Lakes are at risk, we can come together and solve the problem, and I think we can do it again. We just have to show the personal and political will to do it.
Thank you, Dave, for being with us. Dave Dempsey, policy advisor for the U.S. section of the International Joint Commission, and he is author of On the Brink, The Great Lakes in the 21st Century. We're going to not entirely switch focus. You know, the Great Lakes are the Great Lakes. We're looking at what was happening in Lake Erie around Toledo that resulted in a ban on drinking water for several days last weekend. But as you heard Dave say, the Green Bay area, Saginaw Bay are also pretty shallow, and we could be looking at a similar situation here in the state of Wisconsin. So we have a Wisconsin focus, but our guest, of course, who's coming up, will know about what's going on in Toledo as well. We're welcoming phone calls from you, and we're getting many of them. A couple lines are open right now. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. show. Joining us now is Professor Val Klump, professor and associate dean of research in the School of Freshwater Sciences. His research has taken him to the deepest point in Lake Superior and also in Lake Michigan. He's participated in a number of research cruises, which equals a total of over 500 days at sea. And over the past 10 years with the Great Lakes Water Institute has built a great reputation for the organization, which serves as the research arm of UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. Professor Val Klump, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks.
We were talking with Dave, and he just mentioned late in the half hour that we're seeing the problem on the western end of Erie, which is pretty shallow and pretty warm, but we may see a similar situation in Green Bay and also Saginaw Bay. Do you worry about a similar problem in our state?
It's true. It could have that Saginaw Bay and Green Bay have similar characteristics to the western end of Lake Erie. They're both shallow. They're both fed by rivers which contain high concentrations of nutrients. The Fox River, which flows into Green Bay, contains about a third of the total watershed for the whole lake of all of Lake Michigan.
Wow.
Yeah, so something like, you know, more than a third of the total nutrient load that comes to the lake comes into the Fox River. So Green Bay has been, you know, similar to Lake Erie, the western end of Lake Erie, for decades. And has had, you know, nuisance algal blooms and what they call eutrophic conditions for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't yet seen these concentrated blooms of these blue-green algae, Microcystis, but I'm sure it exists in the system. Just upstream of Green Bay in Lake Winnebago, they do have a problem with these blue-green algae, and they have had issues with Microcystis in the water intakes that draw water from Lake Winnebago. It's important to note that Green Bay as a city draws its water actually from Lake Michigan. They have a pipeline which runs across the peninsula sort of there to Kewaunee, and there's a water intake there. So they don't actually draw drinking water directly from Green Bay.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to get a little closer to your phone. The
sure.
Level's just a little. There we go. That's better. So when you heard the story out of Salida last week, were you aghast or were you seeing this coming?
Oh, we've seen this coming. I mean,
really?
Sure. I mean, as Dave correctly pointed out, this has been a problem for a number of years. 2011, we saw an enormous algal bloom, the largest that's been seen in the lakes, even predating the Clean Water Act. And they've measured concentrations of microcystin, which is the contaminant, this toxin of concern, a couple of orders of magnitude higher than was measured in the water intake. So we've known that this is a potential problem for, you know, some time.
And are we better in the state of Wisconsin at dealing with the problems, the reasons for this growth in this algae, than the state of Ohio is?
Well, I don't know whether we're any better at it or not. I would like to think we are. We're a little bit luckier in terms of the morphometry of the lakes and the systems we're working with. We're not stuck with the western end of Lake Erie. So by virtue of the fact that we draw our water from Lake Michigan, which is colder, deeper, and because of the mussels, very little algae in the lake, we don't have a microcystis problem in Lake Michigan, and we're not likely to see one either.
Mm-hmm. What about, I know there was a major conference at Wingspread in April looking at Great Lakes restoration and climate change. Can you take on the issue of climate change here and what the Great Lakes, Michigan, and others may experience as the lakes do warm, as is anticipated?
Yeah, and that's a good point, Kathleen, because our region, the Great Lakes in general, are predicted to be both wetter and warmer as we go into the next 100 years. The warmer obviously causes the onset of the springtime and summertime bloom conditions earlier and earlier, so the period during which you can get these bloom conditions is going to get longer. And Toledo, by the way, is not out of the woods yet because usually the worst of these blooms go right up into toward the end of September.
Ooh.
So they're looking at 2 months yet of having to worry about this problem, at least for this year. And of course, as the climate warms and the summer period extends, then that period during which these algae are really well adapted, high temperatures, is going to extend. The other sort of trigger for this has been springtime conditions where you get a heavy rainfall and a lot of runoff.
Mm-hmm.
That was the 2011 situation in the western end of Lake Erie when they had very big rainstorm in the late spring, and it flushed a lot of nutrients off the landscape into the lake. And then it was very calm and very warm, and that was just like the perfect,
right,
you know, cauldron for these algae to take off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those big pulses, those big rainstorms, that really drive the nutrient loading into the lake. And all of these rivers are very event-driven. So maybe 70 or 80% of the total loading to the lake will come in 10 days, those 10 days where it really rains hard. And as I said, our region is predicted to get wetter, but that wetter is also predicted to come in fewer but stronger rain events. And so that might exacerbate the problem as well by increasing the amount of runoff that we have to deal with because we're having more of these big intense rain events.
Yeah, and my feeling about it, just by looking outside and seeing the rainstorms, that's already happening, that some of the storms we've been getting the last couple of years are really intense.
Yeah, they've been some doozies.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I remember a couple here in Milwaukee. And that is the projection, that there could be as much as a 50 to 100% increase in the number of large rain events. And you're right, it certainly seems like the 100-year storm is coming like every 5 years. So, and that's part of the difficulty we face, is that the infrastructure that we have for storm sewers and dealing with rainwater was developed under a climate which no longer probably mm-hmm. exists. So it was designed for, you know, the 100-year storm, which now is a 20-year or a 5-year storm.
Mm-hmm. So what do we have to do to maximize pollution reductions?
Well, I think Dave had it right. I think, you know, we've done a pretty good job on the point source issue because of the Clean Water Act. You know, we could point our finger to a dozen or so, you know, point sources, whether industries or municipal sewage treatment plants, and we've cracked down on them. And water quality improvements were dramatic, and Lake Erie was a great example. You know, it was dead, and then it recovered. On the other hand, the non-point source issue, the stuff that's running off our city streets or farmers' fields, that we've not done a very good job. You know, we've tried to do it with carrots, as Dave said, but I'm afraid what we do have to have are a few sticks as well. And a part of the problem is you're now not dealing with just a handful of point sources. It's almost a sociological problem. You're dealing with thousands of individuals. Every homeowner, you know, as you correctly pointed out, spreads fertilizer, you know, on their grass.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I have neighbors down the street, you know, when they spread fertilizer, they go right across the sidewalk.
Mm.
You know, and you go crunch, crunch. I tell them, you know, I don't care how much fertilizer you put on that sidewalk, it'll never grow grass, but it does wash off into the lake.
Don't they know that you're their neighbor?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe you need to tell them.
Right. So, but we do need, I mean, non-point source pollution is, I think, the biggest challenge we face in the basin right now, because it is so widespread, it is so difficult to track, and the percent reductions that we need to accrue in order to see improvements are not small. I mean, Green Bay, it's estimated we need to reduce it 40 or 50%.
Wow.
In the western end of Lake Erie, in the Maumee Basin, I think the percentages are about the same. So there's no easy, nor there will be a quick solution to this. But I, as you pointed out earlier, I do think this is a wake-up call.
Hmm.
When,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of a sudden you can't drink the water, you can't wash
it. Right.
Yeah, that should get, I hope it gets people's attention.
You have the attention of members of the audience. We're going to go back to phone calls. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-486-8655. We're taking note of the water drinking ban, which has been lifted on Monday, but for a few days last weekend, people in Toledo were saying, you can't drink this water. It's been filled with poison algae from Lake Erie, the western part of the lake, and we're talking about why that water became poisonous. If this is a wake-up call, not only to people in Ohio, but to other people who get water from the Great Lakes and, well, from many other water sources in the whole country. What do we have to do to keep the waterways clean? Who's to blame for this? Our number, 800-486-8655. And our guest this half hour is Professor Van Klump, Associate Dean of Research in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Rod in Weyerhauser is next. Hello, Rod.
Another good program. Thank you. I was just going to say, you know, it always confounds a person, kind of, you know, I grew up in a dairy farm up here. My dad farmed, and anyhow, he always said this really shouldn't have been farmed because these ridges, you know, left by the glacier and stuff in the air, more apt to have erosion and all that. But the point I want to make is this whole thing is just the engineering of our society to rely on these corporate farms, you know, because, you know, when like NFO was to restore the family farm, you know, back in the 60s, how all this goes hand in hand, because when you had your family, small family farms, and when we went to spread manure, you always spread it on top of the ridge. It's plain and simple because you didn't want it to run off because you didn't want to feed the woods. You wanted to feed your hay crop. You know, it's just pretty simple. Now, you know, when you put farms in there, it's like a fellow was going around with...
Oops.
He was just boiling, you know, about that. And I looked at him. I said, you know, they're not subsidizing the farmer. They're subsidizing the banks. Most of these places... they're owned by the damn bank. Somebody's a manager, but they don't care. They're going to get subsidized because they're going to get this high, potent fertilizer, and just so they have a crop downstream, it don't matter, you know. But when it was small farms, the point is you didn't want it to run off. You wanted the crop to utilize that. And also, I had a question on this blue green algae. Is there any truth to that a blue green algae can actually be used for, for energy source? I'm just kind of curious on that.
All right. Thank you, Rod. Thanks for your call. Are you there, Professor?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Go right ahead. Take it on.
The caller is right. I mean, it's in the farmer's best interest to retain as much of the fertilizer and nutrients on the land as they possibly can. My dad grew up on a farm in the Maumee. On the western end of Lake Erie Basin. My cousin still farms. It's been in the family for over 100 years.
Oh.
And, you know, he's a fairly progressive farmer, I think. He's a cash cropper, but he has all of his land surveyed for phosphorus content. And a soil consultant comes in. They take, I don't know, two or four samples in every acre. And he said, Val, when I drive through the field with my fertilizer spreader, sometimes nothing is coming out, because it's programmed as to which portions of the field actually need it.
Hmm.
And he said it's expensive to do that, but he said fertilizer is so expensive, it pays to use only as much as you need.
Mm-hmm.
And so technology is helping the farmer in some respects. But on the other hand, it's hard to completely retain everything on the landscape. And one of the big sources, it turns out, that's coming off is from tile drainage. Because nutrients actually seep down through the soil, even if it's retained on the land, it doesn't just wash off the surface. Actually, can then get into tile drains and come out. And so, managing tile drains is one of the management practices that people are currently looking at. So it's a complicated issue, and it's true that these big farms are big sources. In some cases, for example, in Brown County, which has, I think, the highest concentration of dairy cows in the country, there are over 100,000 head of dairy cows in that county, and the average dairy cow produces as much waste as about 15 or 20 people.
Wow.
And, of course, that's all spread on the land. Well, think about mm-hmm. that for a minute. You know, 100,000 times, you know, that's equivalent to the waste of roughly 2 million people that we spread on the mm-hmm. land. Now, if that were human waste, we wouldn't tolerate that for a second. But, of course, that's the way it's always been done. And so We need to look at how we deal with animal waste, how we, what kind of management practices can we put in. And I'm reasonably optimistic that we can develop those management practices and reduce the runoff of nutrients into the system, because it's to the farmer's advantage.
Mm-hmm. What about blue-green algae being used for energy, Val?
There are certain kinds of algae, and blue-greens, this microcystin, I don't think is one of them, but there are certain kind of algae they can use for producing biofuels or biochemicals. There are people that are looking at that pretty intensely, and there is some promise there. It's a way of capturing the energy of sunlight to make oil, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rod, for the call. Jocelyn in Sheboygan, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm trying to keep calm here. I am just astounded at the calm demeanor of everyone. We're systematically destroying our planet. Everything that should be illegal, like all these poisons, pesticides, factory farms. I'm a vegetarian for two reasons. For the massive cruelty done to the animals and to the degradation to our planet. I just don't understand it. I don't believe that, that we can manage this so-called, runoff. I mean, it's in the billions of tons. And, when he just said that there were 100,000 cows in one area, and each one of those cows drink at least 40 gallons of water. And then when you add on fracking, mining, and then all the other pollutants that run off, I mean, what does it take? I've got a solution. Stop eating meat. That's a great way to start, and it would end the pollution today.
All right. Would it, Val?
If we ate lower on the food chain,
mm-hmm.
It would certainly reduce our water consumption. There's no question about that,
mm-hmm.
because it's a pyramid. You got to raise crops to feed to cattle, and if you eat meat, that the amount of water required to get your protein from meat is probably an order of magnitude higher than it is from if you have a vegetarian diet.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has said, that the biggest challenge we face in the 21st century is how to live on a planet sustainably without and have a sustainable environment for the future when you got 9 billion people. And I think nowhere is that challenge greater than in the case of water and water issues. I just was on the West Coast, and they're facing an enormous drought out there. So they have a different set of water problems,
right,
than we have here in the Great Lakes. But it is remarkable that we sit on 20% of the world's surface fresh water and can't drink it.
It sure is.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It should be a wake-up call.
Right. Well, what about the phrase that came up the last half hour that for some people, well, it's all downstream from me, so I don't need to worry about it. My water's okay. It's downstream. I don't know what it takes for people to realize that it could happen in their communities. I can understand why Toledo residents are going to be up in arms about this,
yeah,
and marching on the streets. But if you live in another community, well, it's not here yet.
Right. And there's a saying, everybody's downstream from somebody.
Right,
In some respect. But I think, we do need a strong, environmental ethic to say, these lakes have been around for, they're not that old, 10,000 years, but they're going to be around a lot longer. And it's our responsibility to maintain and make sure they are in good shape for the future. Someone said, the future has no constituency. Well, that's true. It's up to us.
Mm-hmm.
My great-great-grandchildren can't back and say, Val, why didn't you do X, Y, and Z? Because now we're having to deal with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem, I think, cuts across all political,
right,
entire political spectrum. Everybody believes we should pay our way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, nowhere is that truer than in the environment and dealing with water.
So. Yeah. Thanks, Jocelyn, for your call. Wendy in Delavan, hi.
Hi. Hi, Professor Klump. I live off of a runoff lake in Lake Delavan, And, you know, we're not that far from Lake Michigan. And I was wondering, does our runoff actually affect Lake Michigan? Like Lake Geneva, I know that's a spring lake, but, like, does that flow eventually get into Lake Michigan?
Well, if you're in Delavan, you're on the other side of the Continental Divide. So, as you know, the Continental Divide here in Wisconsin or in the Milwaukee region is very close. You know, it's you know, Waukesha is on the Mississippi side of the drainage. And so if you're in Delavan, you're on the Mississippi side, so you're not impacting Lake Michigan. But you are impacting anybody who's downstream from you, which includes, you know, St. Louis and New
right.
Orleans and everybody else. And those communities have major water problems, having to treat the water because it's contaminated from upstream. So, and these blue-green algae microcystis problems are not unique to the Great Lakes by any means. I mean, there are lakes all over the world which have these problems. It's estimated something like maybe a third of the water bodies in this country have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to a place like China, it's a total disaster. I mean, because they've had very little environmental regulation. So, but I think it's particularly a wake-up call for us in the Great Lakes, because if we have one fault, I think it's we take these Great Lakes for granted.
Right. Yeah. We shouldn't do that. Carol on Facebook has this message. We're planning a 9-day canoe trip on the Upper Missouri River Breaks National Monument in central Montana. We cannot drink, even with filtration, or wash with river water. Too many agricultural chemicals in the water. What a shame.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
And we need to do something about it.
Wendy, thanks. Nick in Madison, hi.
Hi. I agree with the caller, the farmer, about there wasn't quite this problem with the small farmers. When they put the manure on the field, it was thrown along with bedding and hay in it. But now you get these factory farmers that come in with trucks that go across the field, and it's solid waste. This spring, I went out to a small town, and I couldn't believe this. There must have been 10 inches of solid waste, and it was snow melt at the time, and it created a little lake on top of this small pond on top of this field, and anyways, I followed it and went into the Black Earth Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So I took pictures and did some water samples. I called the DNR twice, but they didn't follow up. And then this spring, there was a report that there was a fish kill.
Oh.
And it was exactly where it was, where I took the water sample.
Yeah.
And I'm a little frustrated with these big farms. And it's not our issue. It's their issue. If they want, like this, the field that was spread was from a 1,200 head of dairy. If they want to be that big, then they have to be able to take care of the waste.
Val, we have about 45 seconds.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And for those that are interested in agriculture, there's a terrific book by a guy by the name of Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms in Virginia. It's called Folks, This Ain't Normal.
Folks, This Ain't Normal.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it talks about how you can raise food, including meat, in a sustainable way. And the shift we've had to industrializing agriculture and just about everywhere we raise food, it comes with those consequences, and we're seeing some of those now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Val, for being with us on such an important issue. Thanks for your expertise.
Thanks for having me on, Kat.
Yeah, our pleasure. Professor Val Klump, he's a professor and associate dean of research in the School of Freshwater Sciences. And it's an important, and it's been around for quite some time and really is leading institution in figuring out how to keep waters clean, what's causing the problems that we were talking about this hour. He has built a great reputation for the Great Lakes Water Institute, which serves as the research arm of UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting program, and thanks to KP as well for doing on-air production, and thank you for contributing to the program with your phone calls and messages. We'll have news coming up from National Public Radio in just one moment, and we'll continue hour two of our program talking about the cost of vaccinations and why they have gone up so significantly over the past few years. That'll be with you after the news.